Jewish liberal utopia. Based on the unity of the Jewish people, the Jewish folk, a realization to which Herzl came, not so much, not at all in fact, by any so-called spiritual impulses, but rather by a realization of the necessity of power in the modern world. And after the Dreyfus case, by an added realization that the Jews do not have such power. His ideal of settlement reflects this liberal ideology. First will come what he calls the poor Jews, which are the Jews of Eastern Europe, who will do the spade work. Then will come the richer Jews, who will bring the capital. This, of course, is again a realism, not anything evil at all, but a kind of realism. In your reading, Herzberg omits, purposefully probably, the detailed plan which Herzl drew up. But that detailed plan stresses good housing, stresses decent working conditions. But its main stress is, as a matter of fact, on free enterprise and the necessity of a market economy for the new Jewish state. Herzl has no intention whatsoever to modify any property relationships. He says, whatever state control there is may not crush free enterprise. We can only be collectivists where there are insuperable difficulties. As for the rest, we want to preserve the individual in his rights. Those rights he defined in connection with free enterprise. Those rights he defined in a liberal way. Private property as the economic basis of Jewish independence shall develop freely and respected by all of us. We want even unskilled labor to rise into a property class. Now you cannot be more liberal than this. You cannot put the liberal ideology better than this. The point is that the dominating personalities of the origins of Zionism, Herzl and Nordau, were both of them committed liberals. Not only liberals, positivists, but also Darwinists. Max Nordau was, after all, the greatest liberal publicist. And the influence that these two famous men should become Zionists found the movement, as it was thought. As one contemporary put it, it was a revelation to Jewish youth that Max Nordau was a Jew. It was an inspiration for them to join the ranks of the Zionist movement. After all, Nordau made his reputation in quite different fields. He is the author of some 9 volumes of novels and short stories, 7 plays, 50 volumes of cultural criticism. And besides all this, he had a lively medical practice. The lesson that you must draw from this is very simple. Why could he do all of this? Why could he do all of this? The answer is very simple. Because he believed he had a certain worldview which goes with this kind of hard work and this kind of accomplishment in the 19th century. His principal idea was ordered progress. Progress based upon the natural sciences. And because he believed in progress, built upon the natural sciences, he believed in clear and distinct ideas, clear formulations of thought, clear ideas of ugliness and beauty. Out of this, he opposed all new forms of literature, which he thought degenerate. And indeed, his most famous book, more famous than all of his latter-day Zionist activity, was his book called Degeneration, which he published in 1892, a very famous book indeed, and which criticizes all modern art and literature as degenerate from the point of view that I have given, the point of view of ordered progress, the natural sciences, and clear and distinct ideas. He had therefore a praise for normal men. What was normalcy? This is how he defined it. Engrave it in your mind. Normal men are those who rise early, who are not weary before sunset, who have clear heads, solid stomachs, and hard muscles. That's why he rode so much. That's why we all try to imitate him as best we can. It's true. That's why he rode and accomplished so much. He wasn't one of these new saints in this generation of new graduate students I hear about who spend their time contemplating their navel. In other words, he worked. He had a world picture. And the world picture meant work, hard work. And hard work was facilitated by his belief in the natural sciences, in progress, in order. And I cannot go into this here, he believed in the old psychology, and therefore he believed also in bodily fitness as a sign of mental health. Therefore, the solid stomach and hard muscle. Don't laugh. I spent all the weekend sewing down trees. So, with a little help from one of the new generation of graduate students, I did too. So anyway, here's an idea. No, with it, however, Nordau had certain concepts of solidarity and of community. He believed, of course, in the community of what he called normal men. Zionism, for Max Nordau, therefore, was a means of the normalization of Jewish life. That is really what it was. It is Max Nordau who, in a speech to the Jewish Gymnastic Organization, remember I mentioned it once before, I talked about it earlier, to the Jewish Gymnastic Organization made this famous distinction, which some of you got very fond of, between muscle Jews and coffee house Jews. Coffee house Jews who are degenerate, part of the nervousness of modern life. He thought it all came through the railway and new transportation. Their muscles, in other words, their nervous system was sick. But the muscle Jew is something else again. The muscle Jew is the normal Jew, the gymnastic organization, the founding of the Jewish gymnastic movement. All this was Nordau's Zionism, really, Nordau's Zionism. Modern artists are sick people. He, therefore, was also illiberal. And it is typical of the very silly extract of Nordau that's given in Herzberg, unfortunately, also. It's typical that he really didn't believe in nationalism a great deal, no more than Herzl. He believed nationalism had been restrained. Herzl and Nordau believed in what we call now a binational state. That is a state where, as Herzl put it, and Nordau too, Jews and Arabs would live side by side in amity. And being both liberals, Herzl, in his novel Old New Country, makes the point that the Arabs must have exactly the same rights as the Jews. All must be the same kind of citizens. This goes for Herzl, this goes for Nordau, this goes for all these founders of Zionism. And it is significant that a man whom I am coming to right now, who came from a different impulse, Ahad Ha'am, accused Nordau and Herzl of too great a tolerance. Quite true, quite true. Accused Nordau and Herzl of too great a tolerance, above all. So that what you have here then is a liberal idea of a liberal state. And notice in your Herzberg page 242 what Nordau says about the restraint that nationalism must have. Now, together with these ideas, Nordau and Herzl obviously believe that the way to attain it was through political methods. And they hoped to persuade the Jewish notables to help them in their politics. But of course, as you now know, by the Jewish notables, they were regarded as oddities in this respect. For the liberal Jews themselves were not interested. Liberal Judaism, that is majority Judaism, from the beginning was anti-Zionist and will remain anti-Zionist at least until the Second World War. Herzl and Nordau's main accomplishment, when you look back on it, was in fact to build a movement. This, I think, in the last resort is more important than their writings. More important than their writings were also their charismatic personalities, their abilities as speaker. Especially Nordau was a fantastic speaker. Their ability as speaker and organizer. That is what is of lasting importance, really. They founded a popular movement, but the populace for the movement came not from the West, but from Eastern Europe. And the attraction of Zionism at first, let us be under no illusion, for the masses of Eastern Europe, was that two distinguished Westerners were at the head of it. That was one of the real and undoubted attractions. This was not merely a shtetl movement of fellow Jews with whom one played pinochle in the evening. This was a movement led by European figures. These men, especially Nordau, was a European figure. That had a great deal of attraction by itself to get the movement going, an attraction that we cannot possibly undervalue. Men who had made their way as writers, not at all as Jews. As I said, it was a revelation to find out that Nordau was Jewish in the first place. But the fact that their support came from Eastern Europe, and the masses of Eastern Europe, whom I think it would be fair to say, neither Nordau nor Herzl ever really understood. They had no means of understanding. Involved them soon in very serious disputes. Disputes which they lost. Max Nordau ends up a lonely and forgotten figure. He did not die till 1925, and when the London Times had an obituary, it hardly mentioned his Zionism. He was the great theoretician of degeneration. But in Zionism, he was a lonely and forgotten figure. Now I believe there's at least one kibbutz and some minor streets, very minor streets, named after him. Unjustly, very unjustly. But he lost, and Herzl lost. And if you will see in a minute that if Herzl had not died so opportunely, no doubt he would have suffered the same fate that Max Nordau did eventually. For the popular masses, which were their following, had their own Zionist tradition. A tradition that is, as a matter of fact, older than Herzl and Nordau. And moreover, a tradition that in the Western context is an anti-liberal tradition. And it is through that dispute and the fact that Herzl and Nordau lost that dispute that Zionism became an alternative to the liberal establishment. With Hanson and Nordau, it really wasn't very much. But because they lost the dispute, it did become an alternative. The anti-liberalism came in from the East. But we cannot make it so exclusive. Whatever I'm going to tell you now about the new impetus and the defeat of Herzl and Nordau, remember one thing from now on in, that until 1933, it is German Zionism, which is in many ways dominant still over the movement. That you must not forget. And that therefore in Zionism, however much Herzl and Nordau lost out, liberal ideas will still play a part. For it will be German Zionism which will be quite crucial in the 20s and until it was cut off in 1933, as you will see again in a minute when I talk about Martin Buber. The opposition to Herzl and Nordau was led on the one hand from Odessa by Ahad Ha'am, and remember what Mr. Orbach said about Odessa. It's a special kind of Haskalah which you had in Odessa, and it was led by another young man, Martin Buber, who had been born in Eastern Europe, but who for all intents and purposes was German and settled in Germany by that time. Now what was this opposition? As I said, the opposition was against the liberalism of Herzl and Nordau. The quest for a return to a spiritual imperative. In other words, it orders itself into the same impetus that you had with the Jewish socialism I talked about. The same kind of impetus, the longing for a spiritual impetus. Not here the Kantian categorical imperative, as it was for the young Jewish socialists, but here, in a way, you will see an equally vague, a spiritual imperative, which was supposed to come from the Jewish tradition. For Ahad Ha'am, Zionism was a matter of a national renaissance, but quite a different renaissance than for Nordau. For Nordau, it was a renaissance of the muscle Jew, clean-cut, liberal, progressive. For Ahad Ha'am, it was a renaissance, as he called it, of the Jewish soul. A phrase that you won't find in Nordau, that I know, I've read all of them, and that I've never found in Herzl either. The phrase of a Jewish soul. In other words, what he wanted was a spiritual renaissance. One, as you will read in Herzberg, which relates itself at every point to the Jewish tradition, not just as a political force in a power play, but as a spiritual one. And indeed, read carefully again in Herzberg, page 262 following, his critique of Herzl and Nordau. Herzl and Nordau are materialists for it, as against a spiritual impulse. It's quite true, Nordau was a liberal positivist, quite true. And above all, that Herzl and Nordau wanted to build a European movement, not a specifically Jewish movement. So that you have a criticism which is, in a sense, from his point of view, a fair critique. And when in 1992, Herzl's novel, Old New Land, appeared, Ahad Ha'am asked scathingly, what is Jewish about it? What he missed about all? And what for Ahad Ha'am was the essence of the spiritual renaissance was the Hebrew language. As Ahad Ha'am put it, an academy of the Hebrew language and literature is worth more than 100 settlements. And that point of view that an academy of a Hebrew literature and language is more worth than 100 settlements is an important one. For Aharon's context is very vague. Jewish tradition, Jewish culture. For Aharon was not a religious Jew in the Orthodox sense. He was a product of that Haskalah about which Mr. Orbach talked to you. Jewish culture, not religion, is what he had in mind. And the question which arose, of course, is what is Jewish culture? And the answer is as vague as it has always been. It's a hell of a lot of things. But he got around it, and by around I don't mean an implication of this. He got around the problem by stressing the Hebrew language and Hebrew literature. For Aharon, therefore, Zionism was a cultural renaissance of the Jews. He is really the father of the movement which we now call the Reconstructionist movement. A spiritual, by which he meant a cultural movement of the Jews. His nationalism was not either a common kind of nationalism. His nationalism was the emphasis on the Hebrew language and literature. But what it meant was this. He deplored Herzl's emphasis on practical work, on colonization, which he thought with some justice meant an ignoring of this culture. His vision was that Jerusalem was to be a cultural center for all the Jews. It doesn't matter how many were settled there. That was quite beside the point. It had to be a cultural center for all the Jews. And he makes an analogy which is very telling. He says, just as in the 16th century, much of the Jewish revival had come from the little hill town of Safed in Palestine, so now the Jewish revival must come from Jerusalem. But Safed had not been an area of dense Jewish settlement. It is, as you know, some of you, a little hill town from which the 16th century revival had come, so it must come from Jerusalem. Ahad's point of view was not shared by many others who criticized Herzl and Nordau for the absence of spirituality. Buber teamed up with Ahad Aham, and so did another young man, Heim Weizmann. Buber, Weizmann, and Ahad Aham authored the attacks on Herzl in the Zionist Congress of 1902. This quarrel was brought to a head by the so-called Uganda conflict of 1903. Herzl, as you remember from the Jewish state, believed that Argentina was perhaps more suitable than Palestine. And so when the British offered the colony of Uganda, Herzl accepted, and Nordau became the great defender of the Uganda project. Herzl was found to renege, not by any difficulties that might have been encountered in Uganda, let's be quite clear about this. Probably, we can defend Herzl on this. Probably Palestine was the worst place to have a new settlement and the most disturbed place, and in a way, it seems then, and the Egyptians unfortunately are not yet in, the worst place because it has always been at the crossroad of big power conflict. And moreover, it was a densely settled area. So that it was, in a sense, Herzl and Nordau had a very good point, but not from the point of view of those who wanted to make it a Jewish cultural revival. Not from those who wanted a new kind of Jewish revival. The Hebrew language and Hebrew literature went together with Zion. However, your religious point of view, well, you could not have really a Jewish revival anywhere else. And that problem is what defeated Herzl and Nordau. They had to renege. 1 year later, Herzl dies. And from then on, the victory is with the other group. For who was to be Herzl's successor? Obviously, Nordau, the obvious man. But Nordau did not get it. The man who got it, his name does not have really to concern us, was another German Jew, very wealthy from Cologne. But Nordau did not get it. Compromise choice. Nordau did not get it. Nordau did not become a success. What triumph then? What triumph is not quite so simple. For Ahadaan's idea that settlement is not important, that what we want is a cultural revival, that idea could not be accepted by the masses of East European Jewry, who wanted to leave their oppression, who wanted to go to Palestine. That was not really a feasible idea within the Zionist movement. But the enemies of Herzl and Nordau nevertheless now benefited. Benefited from a strong organization which Herzl led, and which I said was his single greatest contribution. It isn't Ahadaam's star which begins to rise in the Zionist movement. The idea is too narrow, too fragmented, too partial. That must be clear. But I want to say in parentheses, I want to make it clear to you that at the beginning of Zionism, there were two alternatives. The Zionist movement could have gone the Herzl-Nordau way, then it would have been a liberal movement. It could have gone the Ahadaam way, then it would have saved itself a lot of difficulties. I myself am, I must confess to you, very sympathetic to Ahadaam's way, that I think is most really the only feasible way. I think it is, in fact, but that doesn't really matter. The main thing is, Jerusalem is a spiritual and cultural center. What Ahadaam saw so clearly, what Nordau and Herzl saw so clearly, was the fact, which we must bear in mind, that this was a populated area with an indigenous population. And what they also saw so clearly was that it is, by its very geographical situation, indispensable for one or the other of the big powers. The man whose star rose was Martin Buber. His influence, his star rose, and it rose in spite of the fact that he did not settle in Palestine till 1936. There are reasons for that, which I will go into later. In the Crisis book, which you are reading, you will read about Buber's early nationalist phase. Obviously, the young Buber had the same kind of German nationalist phase which the young Herzl had, which the young Freud had, which they all had. But with Buber, it was to have more large consequences. For unlike Herzl, the nationalist phase was not one which was shed. Buber never came to any kind of liberalism. Indeed, he always opposed it throughout his life. His early nationalism was a phase which, in a sense, was transferred to that nationalism which Buber proposed for Zionism. And here again, I must pause a minute to make something clear. The triumph after Herzl's death was with those who wanted a spiritual renewal, with those who were anti-liberal. But as you will see, first of all, within the anti-liberal camp, There were several alternatives. I'm starting with Boer, because in a sense he became one of the more important. But I will obviously go on to others, to socialism, to the proletarian alternative, and all of that sort of thing. And secondly, I must mention something here, which I will come back to again and again, namely that all these alternatives, all the alternatives of the people of France, have one thing in common with Herzl and Nordau, that is their rejection of an aggressive nationalism. As you will see in a minute, there is in the whole history of Zionism no warrant whatsoever for any imperialism or aggressive nationalism. You may say that is because they realized they were impotent, and that is true in a way. But mainly it is because all these theories have one thing in common. That is to say, out of their theory, they also come eventually to an idea of humanity, just as the socialists did. All these theories, for Herzl a liberal humanity, for Buber a different kind of humanity, for Borosov and the others a different kind of humanity, but they always ended up in an ideal of humanity. In this way, Zionist nationalism will be quite distinct from the nationalisms which will dominate Europe, certainly from 1918 onwards. And I think that is something we must realize from the very start, that this is a very deep trend in the whole growth of Zionism. Now, Buber's alternative refers itself directly to the spiritual, the mystical, which has always, after all, attracted him. One of his very early books was called The Ecstatic Confessions of 1909. And what that early book is a summary, an extract of the confessions people made, mostly Christian saints, under the influence of ecstasy. From the Ecstatic Confessions of 1909, he went on to his doctoral work, which was about the German mystic Jakob Böhme, who in a very direct way foreshadows what he will eventually suggest for Zionism and Jewish nationalism. That great 16th century German mystic who believed in the overcoming, who believed in the being, who believed in a mystical origins or mystical basis of the folk and the nation. His work on Böhme had a similar direction. It is then that he came upon the Hasidim. And in the Hasidim he saw at once, on the Jewish side, the kind of ideals which had attracted him so much on the German side. The Hasidim were, in a way, the Jewish equivalent to Jakob Böhme, to the Ecstatic Confessions. For here, in a Jewish context, seemed the fulfillment of a national mystique, which was also spiritual. Here were the Jewish German mystics, if you like. The Hasidim, as Buber began to explain them, were the true folk, the true people. They exemplified a tradition which was not fossilized, but alive and vibrant. A spirituality, as he put it, the urge towards a spiritual unity within which Jewish creative energies are released. Obviously, these Hasidim are not Mr. Orbach's Hasidim. That must be clear. Mr. Orbach's Hasidim were in the end very fossilized. very devoid of a creative spirit. But Buber was never interested in historical truth. He was interested in building a myth for Jewish nationalism. And the Hasidim that he built up had been attacked rightly by almost every scholar on the subject, most notably by Scholem, attacked very heavily and rightly. They have very little to do with the real Hasidim whom Mr. Orbach talked to you about. But that is not the point. Buber's Hasidim are a mystique, a myth, a creativity. Notice, a creativity that is not orthodox. Buber hated rabbis. That is not orthodox. And a creativity that yet links one to a very real Jewish tradition. Moreover, a tradition that is anti-establishment. He saw the Hasidim, as Mr. Orbach explained, as fighting the Jewish establishment. He didn't see the Tzaddik as a little pinpoint dictator, which he was in reality. He saw it, in a way, as a kind of mystique, as he put it in his most famous work, his Speeches on Judaism of 1911 and 12. These speeches on Judaism are for a Jewish nationalism. In many ways, what the works, in quite different way, what the works of Herder were for the nationalism of Germany, but that is basic. I'm sorry you cannot read them, because they have never been translated. Why have they never been translated? Because they're awkward. For in the speeches on Judaism, Buber not only talks about the Hasidim, but in his effort to give a kind of Jewish cultural revival, he will talk from time to time about the lightening of the Jewish blood. He will from time to time come back to the Jewish race and the Jewish blood. And though Buber never meant it in any racist sense, but rather in a kind of groping for this kind of a tradition, for the Jews were for him without tradition. I must make this quite clear, the problem. He wrote from assimilation, from ethical monotheism. What do you do with the Jews? Anyhow, they have no orthodox tradition. Orthodoxy, a minority, rejected anyway by Buber and most of the Zionists. Rejected. So what are you going to do? Really, for Buber, the Jews were in search of a nationality. And the way to solve this search for a nationality was not to become liberal and to ignore it, as Herzl and Nordau had ignored it. Not to talk merely about the Hebrew literature and Hebrew language, which was after all very narrow, but rather to find a nationality for the Jews. To find a nationalism, and a nationalism which was anti-establishment, ethical, and in a sense even revolutionary. And he found it in the Jewish blood, by which he meant in this kind of Hasidic tradition. For how else are you going to tie together the Jewish people, scattered, assimilated, worse, liberals? In another sense, Buber took up an idea which was current in Europe in general. The difference between the pays politique and the pays réel. The difference between the political country and the real country. The political country, what was that? The Jewish establishment, as it was for others, the establishment of the nation. The pays réel This was the true community of the people. That is what he took up, the chassidim were for him the pei re'er. That must be clear. Now with all of this, Buma then founded Emeth. Emeth, as all nationalisms are based on myth. Emeth, and the fact that it has nothing to do with history is totally unimportant in this context. His speeches on Judaism also stress something else. They stress indeed that Jews must cohere, must become a cohesive force, not only through their blood, through the Hasidim, but they must become a cohesive force also through their translation of this into a vitalism. The influence of Nietzsche is here, it's in general, it is there. An influence of vitalism, an activism. And that activism must be directed against what? Not against any outside or inside enemy, but that activism must be directed toward a renewal of the Jewish people through its dialogue with God. Now, what did Buma mean? Dialogue with God. The speeches on Judaism were given in Prague. They were given to very skeptical young Jews whose relation to God was tenuous at best. What Buma meant by the relationship to God is that you can only come to God through your people, and that, on the other hand, a relationship to God is necessary. And that the way you come in a relationship to God through your people is in the way of the Hasidim, anti-establishment, anti-rabbinical, joyful, and I must add, somewhat vain. But because you come to a relationship to God, it means that you come to a relationship with all of humanity. Therefore, nationalism cannot be aggressive. Therefore, Buma was a great binationalist, and therefore, in the end, Buma hated the state of Israel as it appeared. Because the end is humanity. There is no room for any aggressive nationalism. For in the end, all people are the same. All people are the same. Therefore, all people must live side by side as the same. Finally, this is interwoven always with a kind of mysticism. A mysticism that is difficult to grasp, but I will illustrate it with a personal story. The last time I saw Buma, he said to me, don't you hate to teach at a university which stands on stolen land? And I said, well, that is certainly a point that I myself do not take lightly at all. But the question is, Professor Buma, why do you stay in Israel if you hate it that much? And his answer was very typical, something I'm trying to make clear to you, because eventually the word will come from, oh, I always forget, is it Mount Scopus or the Mount of Olives or something? The word will come from Zion, or not from Zion. From the word will come in Jerusalem, and there are in every nation groups of righteous who band together. These groups of righteous are not definable, but eventually they will coalesce. And the only reason that I am here is that eventually peace will come from Jerusalem. Now these ideas mesh very closely with ideas current in Germany in the World War and after. Ideas also, in fact, adopted by many socialists, namely the union of the righteous. We can say that while so many Germans dreamt of a secret Germany, the poet Stefan Georger of a secret Germany. Buber dreamt of a secret Israel, a secret Israel which would fulfill the union with God, and the union with God would be the union of peace. These ideas of Buber are really the ideas which among many Jewish youth, somebody just mentioned the Hamunim, for example, were of the greatest importance. What is today? Wednesday. Well, don't forget Friday on the Bund and Monday we continue. And I want to see Mr. Gore.